From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Alec Wilkinson has written a new memoir about his mentor and friend William Maxwell. Maxwell was a writer and longtime fiction editor at The New Yorker. He died 2 years ago at the age of 91. On today's Fresh Air, we listen back to interviews with William Maxwell and Alec Wilkinson. Comic Phyllis Diller gave her final performance in Vegas this week, retiring after nearly 50 years in show business. We'll listen back to a 1986 interview with her. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews L.A. Law, the movie, and film critic John Powers reviews Lagan, the Bollywood production from India, which became a huge crossover hit in London and is being released here in theaters and on DVD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The people of Bethlehem are celebrating the withdrawal of Israeli troops following the resolution of the standoff at the Church of the Nativity under a deal brokered by the European Union. 13 Palestinian militants who are on Israel's most wanted list were flown to Cyprus en route to exile in several European nations. 26 other militants were transported to the Gaza Strip. Reporters were allowed into the church today, and the BBC's Orla Guerin says the building is strewn with debris.
Inside the Basilica of the Church, which is the Greek Orthodox area, you can see evidence of a dormitory. This place was used as a sleeping quarters by the protesters and the gunmen during the 5 long weeks of the siege. All around me, lining both sides of the church behind tall marble columns, are what look like improvised beds. There are lots of mattresses on the ground. I can see pillows left and right, a pair of binoculars here just at my feet. Evidence that some people left in a hurry, some shoes and some clothing is still scattered around the floor. And the scene looks quite squalid. A lot of cooking utensils, including some I can see in front of me on an altar where Mass is usually celebrated.
The BBC's Orla Guerin in Bethlehem. She says cleaning crews are already at work and a Mass will be celebrated in the church tomorrow. Former FBI agent Robert Hansen was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole today for selling secrets to Moscow for 2 decades. Before the judge read the sentence, though, Hansen spoke to a courtroom filled with FBI employees. He apologized for his actions and said he is shamed by them and for the damage he has caused, including the damage to his wife and sons, none of whom attended the hearing. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights is considering whether to appeal a federal court ruling that cleared the way for a controversial Bush administration appointee to be seated on the panel. NPR's Pam Fessler has that story.
Commission Chairwoman Mary Frances Berry said through a spokeswoman that she's weighing whether to pursue the case, which has put the commission's majority at odds with the White House. A 3-judge panel ruled yesterday that Cleveland lawyer Peter Kersenow should be seated on the Civil Rights Commission, replacing Clinton appointee Victoria Wilson. A dispute over the duration of Wilson's term has exacerbated divisions between conservative and liberal members of the panel, which investigates civil rights abuses around the country. Berry refused to allow Kersenow, who was appointed by President Bush last December, to participate in commission meetings until legal proceedings were completed. Kersenow is expected to attend the panel's next meeting on May 17th. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 97 points to end the week at 9,939. The market breadth was negative, with decliners leading advancers by a 2-to-1 margin in active trading. On the Nasdaq, the composite index closed down 49 points. This is NPR News. Federal prosecutors say the death penalty is warranted for Zakariya Moussaoui if he's convicted of conspiracy in the September 11th attacks against the U.S. Moussaoui's lawyer has argued that the government can't seek the death penalty because Moussaoui was already in custody on September 11th on immigration charges. But Justice Department lawyers today said by lying to federal agents to cover up the plot, Moussaoui made it possible for the attacks on America to go forward. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan made some upbeat comments about the economy today, just days after the Fed decided not to raise interest rates. Steve Beckner of Market News International has more.
It was a sharp slowdown in business investment in plant equipment and software, along with a drastic reduction in business inventories that caused last year's economic downturn. Now, Greenspan says the long-term outlook for business investment appears increasingly good as firms strive to increase productivity. He also said the fundamentals in the housing market, a mainstay for the economy throughout the downturn, are still solid. Although there has been a significant increase in housing prices, the Fed chairman indicated he does not agree with those who have warned of a housing market bubble, an inflation of housing prices that could burst and hurt the economy. Although the Middle East crisis has been pushing up oil prices, he said it would take a sharp oil price spike to really damage the economy. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
Former President Jimmy Carter travels to Cuba this weekend. He'll become the first American president, past or present, to visit the island nation since Fidel Castro came to power in 1959. The State Department is calling on Carter to urge the Castro government to respect freedom of speech and to move the nation toward democracy. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at www.fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, My Mentor, Alec Wilkinson writes about his relationship with his mentor, William Maxwell. Maxwell was a much-loved, although not widely known, writer and editor. He died in 2000 at the age of 91. Maxwell was the author of several novels and short story collections. From 1936 to 75, he was a fiction editor at The New Yorker, where he worked with such writers as John Updike, John Cheever, Vladimir Nabokov, J.D. Salinger, and Mary McCarthy. Updike described Maxwell's voice as one of the wisest in American fiction, as well as one of the kindest. Maxwell was born in the small town of Lincoln, Illinois, where he lived until moving to Chicago at the age of 14. Much of his fiction was set in the past, in towns like Lincoln. In a few minutes, we'll talk about Maxwell with Alec Wilkinson, author of My Mentor. First, we have an interview with William Maxwell, recorded after the publication of his book All the Days and Nights in 1995, the year he won the gold medal for fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. A lot of the stories in your new collection come out of memories of your childhood. How much do you feel that your memory of your past has been your subject as a writer?
I think about three-quarters of the time, actually. When I was first beginning to write, I wrote largely out of the present. And was alert for any situation taking place around me that could make a story. But the present, though very pleasant, didn't seem to go very deeply into anything. And memories sit on the back of the stove like soup, and they get richer and richer from the things they attract to them, and their wonderful kind of accidental quality. But I also have a kind of abnormal memory, really. My memories go back, as far as I can make out, to when I was 2 years old. And I have quite vivid memories of what before I was four. And it isn't that I haven't forgotten things, but I have remembered things, more things than people usually do. And in my old age, there's an additional vividness to them and detail. And the detail is sometimes so astonishing that I feel everything is there. Everything that ever happened to me is there. It's a matter of unhooking it and bringing it out to the light.
Are you saying that your past has become more vivid to you as you've gotten older?
Yes, much more vivid.
Is there anything that would explain that?
I think it's a common phenomenon. But also, I'm 86, there's a breakdown in the sense of the divisions of time between past, present, and future. The future is problematical, and the present is rather meditative because I'm not involved in an active job. And I read and wander around the house and garden and do things that don't interfere with any kind of meditative process. So there's nothing to prevent the accidental memory from getting into your mind. And I do think memories are attached. Something brings them up. They don't usually force their way up like air through water. But I have had a sense of that the past is no longer different from the present. That I can live in the past as I live in the present. I think some part of my life that I enjoyed very much, and I think, well, enjoy it. It's still here. You're in it, even though the people I haven't seen for 30 years.
Some people really say that people who they've loved who have passed are still with them in a way that they never expected. Do you ever feel that way?
Spooks, you mean?
Well, I don't mean like actual ghosts, but just feeling somebody's presence.
Yes. People often speak of it, really, and they speak of it as if they don't entirely rule out the possibility of ghosts. I think there's another way that people are kept, and that is someone who's especially dear to you, so dear that you can't face the idea of never seeing them again. You take on certain of their qualities. My mother was a very outgoing, hospitable, and quite happy woman. And I'm rather introverted and tend to be shy with strangers and like to be alone, like to read. And when she died, I was only a little boy, and I wasn't ready to give her up. And I haven't given her up. I think about her quite often. As I'm older, I remember her face more vividly. But I also am aware that that I have a kind of sociable life. I don't say that it isn't me, but it's a part of me that developed because I took part of her into my nature rather than let her die.
It was a long time ago that she died. It was 1918 or 19.
Immense time ago.
Yeah. You've written about her a lot.
Yes.
So you think you became more sociable?
I think so. Happy with people. Because she was always happy with people.
Losing her when you were, I think it was 10 years old, to the flu epidemic, it must have made you think that at any moment someone who you love could just suddenly disappear. Because people were dying all around during that epidemic. I mean, so many Americans died. Were you always like bracing for that?
After that?
Mm-hmm.
No. My father was a very strong character and a physically strong man. And once when I was a little boy, I was in a boat on the Illinois River with my father and mother. And he was fishing and we were far out in the middle of the river and a sudden thunderstorm came up. And there were white caps on the waves. And it was quite a way back to the dock. And my father said to get down the bottom of the boat. And my mother was a heavy woman, so he had to pull quite a lot to get her in a hurry through the water. However, we stepped out of the boat just as the cloudburst came down. As long as he lived, and I think I have it still, the feeling of being safe because of him, safe because he was an honest man, safe because he was a decent man, and safe because he was physically strong. So what the effect my mother's death had on me was really that things happen that you don't want to happen, that you can't bear to have happen, and that you must somehow learn that there is no way to get around that fact. So I learned to live with the things that can't be undone.
From 1936 to 1975, you were a fiction editor at the New Yorker magazine. And since we're talking so much about memory, maybe you could remember for us a little bit what it was like to be at the New Yorker back in 1936.
It was a wonderful place. I was hired to see artists, that was the technical name for it. And there at the moment didn't seem to be any office space, so they put me in a bullpen in a corner facing a drawing on the wall by Thurber of himself. But it was outside Mrs. White's office, and so I heard quite a lot that went on in the office. And she was a rather stately woman, very handsome and very stately, and when private matters were being discussed, she would get up from her desk in a stately fashion and walk to the doorstop and release it, and then between the time it took a rather slow door to close, I heard quite a lot. Anyway, she hired me, and Catherine White and Evie White and Wilkett Gibbs and Ross and Thurber, all half a generation older than I was. And I never felt that I was responsible for the making of the magazine. But I admired them. I also had reservations because I was already a novelist when I got there. And I read enormously, and I saw that there were certain areas that they were unwilling to touch.
Like what?
Well, it was astonishing now. They've long since got over that inhibition, but they wouldn't publish a story that involved the Jewish question. They wouldn't involve a story that involved homosexuality. There were several things that they felt simply inappropriate, which was formed a kind of straitjacket. Eventually, of course, everything and every kind of language has crept into the New Yorker, but this is the way it was when I went to work there.
As a fiction editor at the New Yorker, was it your responsibility to carry out certain parameters of discretion, you know, to respect certain parameters of discretion, so to speak, that you didn't really respect yourself?
I didn't have to carry them out. I just had to submit to them. For example, there was a John Cheever story which had the sentence in it, Coverley, with love in his heart and lust in his trousers, walked across the across the lawn. And the editor at that time, William Shawn, said it couldn't be published. I thought it could be published. I didn't see why it couldn't be published. I thought it was a wonderful sentence, but it didn't get published.
Shawn won.
Shawn won.
Of course, I suppose.
Yes. Yes. He had all the cards, but I think Wright was on my side.
So what was that exchange with Sean like? Were you in his office talking with him? Was this a back and forth on paper that happened?
It was in his office. He put it in on a when the manuscript came back, he said it should be cut. And so I went to his office to explain didn't think it should be cut. And I thought it was a good sentence. So he said it shouldn't, and I said it should stay in the story. And he said it shouldn't. So I just gave up and walked out of the office. What more could I do? I knew him well enough to know he wasn't going to change his mind.
And what did Cheever have to say about it?
I think I told John and apologized, but that's all. He had many grievances against the New Yorker, but that doesn't seem to have been one of them.
We're listening to a 1995 interview with the late writer and editor William Maxwell. He's the subject of the new book, My Mentor, by Alec Wilkinson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1995 interview with the late writer and editor, William Maxwell. He's the subject of Alec Wilkinson's new book, My Mentor. I think of how much the world has changed since you were a boy, from, you know, horse and buggies to, you know, moonwalks and portable computers and all of that. Do you feel like you still make an effort to keep up with all the big changes, technological and otherwise, or is it not important to you now?
I don't say I make an effort not to keep up, but I certainly don't make any effort to keep up. For example, I use a typewriter, not a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Mitchell, my colleague at The New Yorker, is fond of a Quaker phrase, which is very convenient, when there's something, some current manifestation, he says, it doesn't speak to my condition. And if you're 86, of course, lots of contemporary things don't speak to your condition. Your condition is placed 30, 40, 50, 60 years earlier. I liked the world I came into as a child. My father liked new things. He thought all the new inventions were marvelous. And in general, I've tended to hate them. I would so gladly put an end to all flying machines, all automobiles, all mechanical means of locomotion except the horse and buggy. It was a beautiful world. I loved the sound of the horse clop, cloppity, clop, clop going past the house. It was unhurried. It left time for brooding and thought. It left time for being nice to other people. It left time for making presents instead of buying them. It left time for telling stories.
The late writer and New Yorker magazine fiction editor William Maxwell recorded in 1995, 5 years before his death. In the new book, My Mentor, Alec Wilkinson writes about his relationship with William Maxwell. Wilkinson has written for The New Yorker since 1980. They met when Wilkinson was a child, and his father and Maxwell were best friends. Wilkinson dedicated three of his books to Maxwell. Wilkinson was included in one of Maxwell's dedications, and Maxwell wrote the introduction to Wilkinson's book, Midnights. I spoke with Alec Wilkinson in 2000, just after William Maxwell's death. I asked him to describe Maxwell's writing.
He was a terrific, elegant stylist, immensely succinct, extremely complicated construction to his novels and stories, but all done to appear as if no effort had been expended at all. Only the most careful reader would be aware of the intricate architecture and the work that had been done to lay a word upon word as if he were building a stone wall. But he's a meticulous craftsman, a writer's writer. He was very fond of a remark that had been made, by a writer named John Hall Wheelock. I'm roughly paraphrasing, that writing involves the imposition of a line of words on a line of feeling. And I think more than any other writer I can think of, the emotional core of Maxwell's work is always paramount and profound.
Maxwell was a longtime fiction editor at The New Yorker, and among the many illustrious writers he edited were J.D. Salinger, Vladimir Nabokov, John Updike. Tell us a little bit about his reputation as an editor.
There was no one better. He was the great fiction editor of the middle and late period of the 20th century. But he was, as remarkable as his stature as an editor is, I think he's a much better writer. He was able to be such an acute editor, I think partly out of a great generosity of spirit. He was never, unlike any editor I've ever otherwise known, except perhaps William Shawn, he never appeared threatened by another writer's work. He never felt an obligation to impose his own taste upon another writer's work. He delighted in varieties of style, and even though he was a complicated stylist himself, the difference in style, for instance, from John Updike to Salinger to Frank O'Connor, another one of Maxwell's great writers, and to Nabokov is as broad a range as I can think of the period in English.
He worked with you on some of your writing, and yeah. You say that he would take his scissors and cut up your sentences and rearrange them and paste them back together. Tell us more about this method and what you got out of it.
Well, he surely never worked with a writer less developed whose work was in more of a raw state than mine was, simply because I didn't start writing till I was 24. I was a rock and roll musician before that, and I just had this idea to start doing this, and so there was a lot to clean up. It was like you had bought a piece of property that on which no one had cut the grass or attended to the shrubs for a long time, and you just had to get out there and clean things up. So he would really do that. I remember in my first book, I had a scene, a fairly long chapter, with part of which was a monologue involving one character, and then there was it was followed by a scene involving this in two characters, one of them the one who had spoken the monologue, and he took out the scissors and glue and combined the two scenes so that into something that was quite comical, because you now had one man going on in a rather sort of gassy monologue being interrupted constantly by somebody in the background who was having a kind of antagonistic conversation with him. And it was that sort of thing that began to make me aware of, you know, I'm sure plenty of other editors might have read the same chapter and kind of thrown up their hands and thought it was hopeless. But Bill would really, and on that particular day, we had sentences all over the desk, and I kept sort of shifting them around. I remember his losing patience with me and saying, if you think this is a game, it isn't. Put those sentences down. But we just, you know, that was as radical a piece of editorial intervention as I ever saw him engage in. But it was what I think a writer valued and depended on and leaned on Maxwell for was his judgment. And I always felt that if I showed something to Bill and he read it and found it passable, then there was no other judgment I cared for above that. No one I knew was capable of either greater penetration or greater certainty or greater estimation of what value, if any, something I had contained. And I've heard this from all of the writers whose names you mentioned earlier. Have also more or less, we all seem to be in agreement about the benefit of his company, his counsel, his estimation of your work.
Now, I believe William Maxwell worked with you more as a friend than as a professional paid editor.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Well, yeah, Maxwell was my father's closest friend. And when I started writing, I knew one of Bill's daughters, Brookie. I actually knew them both, Kate and Brookie, but it happened to be that I saw Brookie at one point and she knew that I was writing and asked her father if he would look at what I had done. And at the same time, my father had also said to Bill, would you take a look at this? And he had already left. I got to the New Yorker in 1980. Bill retired from the New Yorker in, I think, 1976. So we never actually worked together through anything but love, really.
Alec Wilkinson is the author of the new book, My Mentor, A Young Man's Friendship with William Maxwell. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Comic Phyllis Diller gave her final performance this week, retiring after nearly 50 years in show business. We'll listen back to a 1986 interview with her. Also, David Bianculli reviews L.A. Law, the movie, and wonders why the networks are living in the past. And John Powers reviews the new Bollywood film, Lagan, which was a crossover hit in London and is opening here. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sunday night, NBC presents L.A. Law, the movie, one of many special TV offerings this month tied to the television of the past. TV critic David Bianculli has a review and some complaints.
It isn't that L.A. Law, the movie, is all that bad. What's disappointing is how average it is. And, in a larger context, how this entire TV nostalgia craze has gotten ridiculously out of hand. Now, I love old TV as much as the next guy. In fact, unless the next guy is a curator at the Museum of Television and Radio or teaches TV history at Syracuse University, I love TV a lot more than the next guy. But even I am bored to tears these days by the reunion specials that are popping up almost nightly. A MASH reunion, which happens next Friday on Fox, is one thing. But why watch a reunion of the cast members from Laverne and Shirley when I didn't like the show the first time around? When you sink as low as to have a reunion special based on That's Incredible, and I'm not making that up, things have gotten incredibly out of hand. We have Carol Burnett to thank and greedy TV executives to blame. We have Carol Burnett to thank because her primetime special last November, in which she and most of her former co-stars told old stories and showed old clips, ended up being the year's most popular entertainment special, except for the Oscars. No one in TV saw that coming. This was at least the third Carol Burnett clip show presented by CBS over the years, and none of the others had drawn nearly as many viewers. But all of a sudden, vintage TV was in, and every network ordered up specials for the May sweeps. That's the period we're in now, when the networks do everything they can to grab viewers, because advertising rates for the fall are based on the audience levels attracted now. Yet if the networks were serious about TV history, they'd know that what they're doing is killing their own golden age goose. Whenever one network strikes gold in an unexpected vein, ABC with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, CBS with Survivor, and now this nostalgia craze, all the other networks flood the airwaves with imitations. That's why we've had to suffer through game shows and reality shows by the scores, and why ABC scheduled so many weekly editions of Millionaire that no one wanted to watch anymore. TV history tells us this happened with the Westerns, when Gunsmoke led to literally dozens of imitators on the air at the same time, and to the quiz show, until the scandals killed that genre for decades, and to the variety show, until the Captain and Tennille and the Starland vocal band did pretty much the same thing. This month, most of the reunion specials have been content to show old clips, grab a few new guests, and attract surviving cast members to let us see how they have or haven't aged. A few of these nostalgia shows actually put the old actors back into their old roles. Part of Tuesday's Laverne and Shirley reunion did that, and it was not a pretty sight. All of Sunday's L.A. Law movie does it, and it's not that great either. Once you get past seeing everyone again, a telemovie reunion rises or falls on the strength of its story. L.A. Law falls, because even without all the exposition covering the lives of these characters over the past decade, what we end up with is a subpar episode of The Practice. Here's Corbin Burnson as divorce attorney Arnie Becker going through his own divorce and being opposed by a surprisingly familiar lawyer representing his soon-to-be ex-wife.
Hello, Arnie.
Abby?
Long time no see.
You're Laura's attorney.
Is there a problem?
Yes, there is a problem. She used to work here.
Well, that is a problem. To the extent that you have confidential information about this firm gained during your employment here, I'm quite sure your partnership agreement precludes you from making use of it.
You're Douglas's kid.
Right.
My, how time flies. First of all, I was never a partner here, so there is no partnership agreement. Second of all, I left the firm 10 years before Arnie and Laura met, so any information that I may have would be woefully out of date. Shall we proceed?
No, we shall not. What firm are you with?
Law Offices of Abigail Perkins.
You're a sole practitioner.
I have 8 associates working for me. Hi.
Hello.
This is the deposition of defendant husband Arnold Becker to be conducted by plaintiff attorney Abigail Perkins.
You can stop typing, because defendant husband Arnold Becker will be marching into court to obtain a protective order barring said plaintiff attorney Abigail Perkins from coming anywhere near this case.
Unlikely you're going to get that, Arnie.
Nice to see you, Abby.
Sorry. But to me, that scene feels written and staged and not at all convincing. Most of the movie is like that. I remember the good old days when L.A. Law was fresh, and I prefer to hold on to those memories. I've gotten much more enjoyment this month out of the good news shows, watching Alias and 24, and programs like that. And they've both been successful enough that next year, we're likely to see a lot more shows like them.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, an interview with comic Phyllis Diller. She just retired from show business. This is Fresh Air. Phyllis Diller has retired from show business at the age of 84. This week, she gave what she said would be her final performance in Vegas. Diller was one of the first and only women comic headliners of her generation. Her persona as a crazed housewife, her jokes about her husband Fang, and her many rounds of plastic surgery didn't exactly set the stage for the feminist revolution, but she did pave the way for other women comics. Here's a performance from 1961.
But I know exactly where the trouble spot is. It's middle age. And here's what happens. A woman hits 40, going 90 miles an hour. And boy, that's a crack up. One morning, she gets up, she looks in the mirror, she punches the panic button. She says, I gotta be younger by lunch! She'll go through a whole list of idiotic ideas like renting smaller children. But 9 out of 10 will rush off to a plastic surgeon. Or go under the knife, as we say at the clinic. And are you ready for the big fallacy? They all expect to come out looking like Tinkerbell. So what if you do? What are you going to do about the rest of it? Gravity's been pulling on it for 40 years. I hate that word gravity. It reminds me of a little personal tragedy. 2 weeks ago, my Playtex living bra died of starvation. I mean, if just once I could throw up my arms and say, my cup runneth over.
Phyllis Diller got a late start in show business. She was a 37-year-old mother of three when she started to perform. In her close to 50-year career, she performed in the persona of a crazed housewife. We spoke in 1986, and she told me about developing her act.
It was very different because I had no idea what I was doing. Therefore, I was terribly different. There were no female comics around. I was it. I didn't know that. But I had no precedent. I had never seen anything excepting what I had seen on the early days of television. In black and white, like Milton Berle, Maury Amsterdam, Art Carney, all men, and there they were. And so I was drawing on my background, my educational background. I did the spoof of a concert, a classical concert. I started with Handel, went through German Lieder, and I did the German, and then I did phony captions, you see. I did a parody of Amahl and the Night Visitors by Giancarlo Minotti, and in my version, her son had lost all his marbles. I did Ima Sumac. At that time, I had a very high voice. And my drum was an oatmeal box. And I had a band on my head with baby shoes and bottle caps. It was madness. I didn't have any idea. I made fun of current high fashion. And finally, little by little by little, I got material. Little by little. I used to read Dear Abby columns and change a few words to make them silly.
How did you start telling stories about Fang, the husband that you use in your routines?
That was an ad lib. I remember in The Purple Onion when I was searching for material, trying out new things every night, and I had a bit about having had an accident in the car, his car, of course, and how I was calling home after the accident to tell old Fang Face. Because the minute you're in trouble, he's the heavy. And I worked on it and realized that I was on to something because this idiot that I portray on stage has to have a husband. And he's got to be even more idiotic than I.
Did people assume that Fang really was your husband, that you had this, like, absolutely crazy husband?
Well, they still do. Every time I'm seen with a man, they say, are you Fang? Everybody wants to meet Fang. Everybody wants to see Fang. Everybody is interested in Fang. They love him. I've built a monster.
How did your husband feel knowing that people would assume that he was Fang?
My first husband adored the idea of being known as Fang. He loved it. He had stationery made up with nothing but Fang on it. And he liked it very, very much. I guess it gave him some sort of importance, which he enjoyed.
Well, let's talk about the character you invented for yourself.
Oh, how about
her? On stage, yeah. Okay, describe the way you will typically come out for a performance.
Like a maniac, dressed silly, with silly hair, funny little boots, little gloves. All clowns wear gloves, even Mickey Mouse. And I wear gloves, the little teeny short gloves, and a little short dress, and that's it. It's a funny persona. And this woman is an idiot, you know. She's a harridan. She comes out. She's telling everybody what's wrong with everything, you know. Please.
So you designed your own image. You designed your own clothes, too? Did you decide what to wear on stage?
Well, you see, I used to dress pretty square, pretty straight. The first few years, I wore actual... One year, I wore Chanel suits. Another year, I wore a Balmain suit. And they were satin and shiny. And I realized I had to wear something shapeless or I couldn't make jokes about my body.
Because your body was too nice?
That's right. I hate to tell you that. So then I invented shapelessness. And to this day, I wear shapeless things so that I can tell them anything I want about my body.
What was your self-image like then? Because you'd get on stage and talk about how ugly you were and how, you know, your husband wouldn't come near you and all these jokes about that. And in fact, you probably had a terrific figure. You're probably, you know, a good-looking woman, but you'd made yourself into a crazy woman for the performance. So what was your self-image like deep down inside?
I was so busy carving out a career that I didn't have much of a problem with it. I mean, I wasn't a beauty. I was never a beauty. A beauty is sort of a way of life. A beauty is sort of the way you act. Beauties are soft and they talk a certain way. Beauties don't talk like I talk. You know, I'm into the nitty-gritty. I'm into editing. See, my mother, when the phone rang, she picked it up and said, "State your business." So you see, I was not brought up to be a beauty.
In your routines, you do pretty rapid fire.
Well, 12 laughs a minute is as fast as anyone can talk.
How do you build it up? Is there a model that you have about how jokes should build and when the capper should come on?
Oh yes, the final word must be the joke word, must be the operative word. The final word should end in an explosive consonant, like pop, or puck or kook, you understand? There are mellifluous words. Mellifluous is one of them. It flows. It's pretty, you know. It's one of those lovely words like lavender. You want something strong and pop at the end, like a shot. For years and years and years, people likened my delivery to machine gun fire.
Is there... a rule of thumb you use about how many you can tell in a row like that before changing the subject?
Yes.
A sense of rhythm about that?
You find that out by doing them. You have a whole... You want to do as many as you can on one subject because you see it's economy. You have one setup and then all the tag, 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 tag. You don't have to repeat the setup because every time you do a tag, it has to have a setup. But if you can have one setup and then as many as possible... lines, but there is a limit to how many they will take on one character.
Can you give an example of the setup and a few tags?
Well, she's so fat that. That's your setup. And then you've got all these tags, like sa-da-ba-da-dum, ba-da-da-doom, di-doom-doom-doom-doom. It's music.
You always strike me as being the forerunner of, say, Joan Rivers, you know, that like one of Joan Rivers' models, for a few reasons. First of all, because you're two of the few women who've made it to your stature in the world of comedy, but also because of your self-deprecating kind of humor, which she really has gotten into. Do you see any connection? Do you know her well?
Yes, she's my dear friend, and I don't know any other way for a female comic to get on. You have to beef about something because comedy is tragedy revisited. That's my definition of comedy. People say, what is comedy? Okay, if you come out and you're lovely and you... there's no comedy. So self-deprecation and denigration is par for the course. works.
Do you think it's different for women than for men? Do you think that women more so have to have that kind of humor?
They need a little more help than men do because there's a double standard. Men can talk raunchy without being pilloried. Women are it's the Madonna complex, the Madonna syndrome. They're the mothers, the softies. And when a woman is going to be hard enough and aggressive enough to do comedy, she better have some saving graces. Like, look, I'm humble. I don't think I'm pretty.
Did you have to do that? I mean, do you feel like you had to do that to get in or something?
No. Uh-huh. Remember, I didn't know anything about what I was
doing.
Right,
okay.
Look, if I hear a laugh, it stays in. It's very simple. Like, if the bucket doesn't leak, don't repair it.
You recently had plastic surgery, well, several times.
All the time.
All the time? what have you had?
Oh, have you got an hour? I've had everything. I've had 3 facelifts. The latest thing, I had that eyeliner put on, permanent tattoo. I had a chemical peel. I had a breast reduction. I had a tummy tuck. There's only one procedure I haven't had, and that's liposuction surgery or lipectomy, where they use a vacuum thing that was invented in Paris to suck out unwanted fat from places on your body where exercise doesn't affect.
Why did you have all the plastic surgery?
I was ugly and beginning to look old.
Mm-hmm. Well,
old and wrinkled and hangy.
Uh-huh.
We're talking droop. Droop city.
It's interesting because you'd made your career on being crazy looking, on putting yourself down, on being the frumpy housewife.
True.
So now, I mean, you have, you look rather glamorous.
I hope so. But you see, I'm a single woman and I have a private life. My private life is very important to me. Very important. That's my real life. My life on stage is not real. I am a person. I am real. And I want to look good.
If you had the perfect nose and lips and breasts and everything when you were getting started, do you think you would have gone into comedy?
Well, I did have the perfect breasts, the perfect figure, and my nose was crooked. Let me think. My teeth were crooked. Well, comedy is within. It has nothing to do with your appearance. My appearance helped because it was dysplastic. It helped. And then I made it help more by getting crazier and learning to be theatrical and things like that.
So you have 2 personas, as you always did, one off stage and one on stage. And how are you dressing on stage now?
Crazy. But chic. I mean, it's satire of what is chic right now. That's the way I dress.
Are you still talking about Fang?
Oh, honey, he's so big in my act. He's one of my big numbers.
Did you like wife jokes when how do you feel about them now?
I think they're wonderful. I love jokes. I love comedy. I worked with male comics who said, you've heard this is a classic because more than one comic I've heard say it, is where he's married to the woman who's so neat. She's always, everything has to be perfect. And, men don't like that. The joke that I loved, when he got up to go to the toilet one night, came back, the bed was made. Have you heard that joke?
No.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Can't you see this compulsive woman?
Yeah.
Making this man's life miserable?
The problem I've always had with wife jokes is that they always seem to be about the whole genre of women. Because they were never spouse jokes, because until you came along, there were no women telling jokes. So the joke was always on the woman and never on the man. So instead of being jokes about married life or having this lifelong companion, it was always jokes about women, jokes about dames. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it seemed to put down the whole gender instead of talking about the tribulations of a long-lasting relationship that men or women would have. Do you know
True.
What I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. But I did some good work, didn't I?
Yes.
I almost have a cause.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been such fun, Terry. I really love your show.
Thanks. Thanks for being here.
Phyllis Diller recorded in 1986. This week, the 84-year-old comic gave what she said would be her final performance. Monday on Fresh Air, we're going to get an early start on celebrating the centennial of composer Richard Rodgers. He was born June 28, 1902. We'll feature a concert of Rodgers' songs with singer Rebecca Kilgore and pianist, singer, and songwriter Dave Frischberg. We're going to take a Richard Rodgers moment now and hear Tony Bennett singing the Rodgers and Hart song, This Can't Be Love.
This can't be love because I feel so well.
No sobs, no sorrows, no sighs. This can't be love. I get no dizzy spell. My head is not in the sky. My heart does not stand still. Just hear it beat. This is too sweet to be love. This can't be love because I feel so well. But still I love to look in your eyes. Does not stand still, just hear it beat. This is too sweet to be love. This can't be love because I feel so well, but still I love to look in your eyes. I love to look in your eyes.
Coming up, film critic John Powers reviews the new Bollywood production, Lagaan. This is Fresh Air. One of the world's two biggest film industries is located in Bombay. Americans rarely have a chance to see movies from India, but that might change with the release here of Lagaan. The film has opened in New York and L.A. and is out on DVD. Film critic John Powers has a review.
If any country is hot these days, and I'm referring to more than climate here, it's India. Magazines fill their pages with subcontinental fashions. Each week seems to bring the advent of yet another dazzling Indian novelist. And Hollywood's beginning to strip mine ideas from the massive Indian movie industry, affectionately known as Bollywood. Just last year, Ghost World began with Thora Birch watching a Bollywood picture. And Moulin Rouge built to a huge production number gleefully modeled on the kind of giddily extravagant musical routines you find in films from Bombay. Yet despite all this India chic, most Americans have never had the chance to see a Bollywood movie. But all that could change with the arrival of Lagaan, which has already been a huge crossover hit in London and been nominated for an Oscar here. This hugely enjoyable new epic, it runs nearly 4 hours, is unlike anything you've ever seen. It's like a bizarre cross between Rocky, Oklahoma, and Gandhi. Set during the vanished British Raj, the story takes place in the poor village of Champaner, which has suffered from 2 years of drought. But the local English commander, Captain Russell, played with lip-smacking villainy by Paul Blackthorne, cuts the villagers no slack when it comes time to ante up their lagaan, the heavy tribute they must pay their rulers each year. Russell proposes a bet to the film's hero, Bhuvan, who's played by the Indian superstar Aamir Khan. If the villagers can beat his English regiment in a game of cricket, he'll cancel the lagaan for 3 years. But if they lose, they must pay triple their tribute that year, an amount that would literally lead them to starve. Although none of the Indian peasants even knows how to play cricket, the headstrong Bhuvan accepts and begins cobbling together an implausibly ragtag team of cricketers. Of course, that's just the beginning. Bollywood movies are all about gleeful excess, and Lagaan keeps ratcheting the action higher, with vile Captain Russell growing even more cruel and dishonest. The village cricket team discovering athletes with oddball talents, but being infiltrated by betrayers. And Bouvan becoming the object of romantic longing for two women. The village girl Gowrie, played by gorgeous Gracie Singh. And the elegant Englishwoman Elizabeth, who just happens to be Captain Russell's sister. And that's not all. In Bollywood, a movie barely deserves the name if it doesn't contain big musical numbers. And Lagan obliges with several spectacular song and dance routines to music written by Indian pop hero A.R. Rahman, whose sound is as familiar there as Moby's is here. In this song, dozens of water-parched villagers bound ecstatically over the barren countryside to celebrate what they think is an impending rainstorm. Bollywood movies once had the reputation for seeming amateurish to Westerners, but Indian filmmakers have begun reaching out to the international audience. Not only is Lagan technically superb, director Ashutosh Gawrikar has a far better sense of pacing and space than most Hollywood filmmakers, but the movie's Anglo-Indian storyline gives it a cross-cultural allure. In fact, English actress Rachel Shelley, who plays Elizabeth Russell, is now a huge star on the Indian subcontinent. For millions, she's the dream of the lovely, enlightened Englishwoman who could fall for an Indian peasant. There are many such dreams in Lagan, which is shot through with a romanticized vision of Indian life, led by star Aamir Khan, who really knows how to move and boasts the confident, charismatic good looks that poor Indians can only aspire to. When Bhuvan's cricket team finally takes the field against their oppressors, they're no mere collection of villagers. They're a utopian dream team of national harmony, in which Hindus and Muslims play together side by side, and even a crippled untouchable proves to be one of the heroes. They achieve a community that India itself is still struggling toward today. Lagan builds to the climactic three-day cricket match that, with typical Bollywood understatement, runs as long as an entire Rocky movie. Talk about milking it. This game has everything. Heroism and perfidy, injury and redemption, weeping and laughter, romantic exaltation and teeth-gnashing fury, athletic grace and wicked foul play, not to mention yet another lavish song and dance number. By the time the game finally ends, and the skies open, and the music soars, I know you'll agree with me when I tell you that Lagan is not a film that leaves you asking for more.
John Powers is executive editor and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. मधुबन में जो कन्हैया किसी को पीस मिले कभी मुस्काए कभी छेड़े कभी बात करे राधा कैसे न जले. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of With These Hands, a collection of stories by Louis L'Amour, author of May There Be a Road. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island too.
On the next Fresh Air, a centennial tribute to composer Richard Rodgers, featuring performers Rebecca Kilgore and Dave Frischberg. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
It's very fancy on old Delancey Street, you know.
The subway charms us so.